Music makes people come together at festivals, gigs and clubs. We share epic moments. Best friends for the entire set or the rest of our lives. Heineken, live your music. To get your hands on tickets to all the best gigs and festivals, tap this ad or visit heinekenmusic.ie. Enjoy Heineken responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.
That's right, I'm back. It's Roisin Murphy and you're listening to The Sync Sessions, brought to you by Heineken Live Your Music. Well, I have to say it is a great pleasure for me to welcome the lovely Vinny and the lovely Dave from Django Django.
Hello. Hi there, how's it going?
It's good, yeah, it's fabulous. Now you're here, you little smiley
straight
faces.
Straight off the bat, my phone's good.
Your mum.
It's my mum. I'm going to tell.
His mother is ringing him.
That's good.
Where are you? So we'll jump straight in, start talking about the beginning and how you guys met. We've got two members of a group of how many?
Four.
And you've all known each other from the beginning, or have you changed personnel?
No, same four since the start.
When was that?
Me and Tommy went to art school in Edinburgh in the 90s, or late 90s, mm-hmm. and started tinkering around with synths and drum machines and whatnot.
Yes.
So I guess it almost goes back that far. I had a sampler and was making hip hop and stuff, and then got to move down to London and met up with Vinny and spoke about doing more of a band thing, more songs rather than dance music.
I was at the same university as you.
But I didn't know you really.
I was in the architecture department.
He was an architect. So me and Tommy were painting.
Like Dave with DJ in our local student union, and we had kind of mutual friends and stuff.
Yes.
So yeah, we just kind of, I knew he was doing stuff and I was kind of just diddling, you know, writing wee tracks just on a wee dictaphone, just recording stuff in.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just down in London. Then we kind of got together and started kind of working on stuff together.
And when you say an dictaphone, so not a no accompaniment,
just straight from an acoustic, just
guitar. You were playing
pre-mobile phone, days.
Yeah. And you guys were more like kind of what I was doing, I guess, sort of duo, two people in the studio working with electronics and
it wasn't
computer.
It wasn't even that. It was like two guys in a bedsit in Edinburgh. Like an Atari computer, like one of the old Atari computers with Cubase on it.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I know, it was great. I had a sampler. I mean, that was the beginnings of me trying to get into production, really, trying to make techno and stuff.
And this came out of DJing for you?
Yes, I was DJing already since 92, around then.
Yeah. So it seems like a long time then between you guys meeting. It was a long gestation. It was a long process of realising that you were actually in a band, the four of you then, because it's not till 2012 that you release your first album. Is that right?
Yeah. I think a lot of time was spent in pubs.
Oh, aye.
Talking about being a band and not get it. I think it was
Did you do live circuit? Did you do much live stuff before you recorded?
We did a first couple of tracks and stuck them up in MySpace, and then we got a couple of gig offers. We'd meet up once every 3 or 4 weeks, do a track, and then kind of disappear for 5 or 6 weeks.
This was all in London?
Yeah.
And do you feel you were part of any kind of music scene in London at that time?
Well, we were living in Dalston when it was kind of just starting to, you know, it was getting kind of interesting around there.
Mm-hmm.
See, there was loads of club nights and just all over the place. And so maybe we probably weren't part of a scene, but we certainly were going to a lot of places that had
more
quite
like
exciting.
You were going to more clubs than live music?
Yeah.
Because it's interesting that your background doesn't sound like what you look like in a way, because you seem to be a band in a way, even though there's lots of evidence of what you're interested in, probably even more than that. But it's kind of weird that you didn't come from having seen loads of bands and being a bandy, because usually it's, say if I'm talking to Oasis or, you know, somebody like that, it's like we knew this other band over there and we were in this rehearsal rooms and then we went to these pubs and we all played, and it's not that story, is it?
I wasn't really into that, like, at all. When we were starting to form a band, I didn't like the idea of being in a band. Like, it always was slightly cliched to me.
Yeah.
It was almost like a project. Like, I remember we sat in the pub and we were like, I wonder if we could start a band and like write songs.
Well, I think there was a realisation when we'd had like four tracks. We were like, we can't keep going, just us two.
You were working with the other lad from Edinburgh.
Way back.
Right.
So that's how I thought, well, let's get him. He's got an analogue synth, so like a nice one. So get him along.
So what jobs were you all doing then at that stage?
At that point, I was at Chelsea Art School doing like a postgrad in painting. And then I was working in a bar, doing furniture removals, DJing. I think we were just, you were like a proper architect.
Yeah.
You were in the architecture.
Yeah, I was in an office and everything. And then it just got to a point where once we started doing gigs, I couldn't, you know, I was coming in to the, you know, to work and forgetting to put two floors on a building and turn up to a planning meeting and get a, you know. So
people were like spotting you in the NME and...
Yeah.
Were you already designing buildings, or were you part of a bigger team? Or
it was like a small, like five person practice. So I was doing like little country retreats and the big office blocks and everything. So it was quite a weird mix, because like I would try to call out my lunch hour to do XFM or something, you know, like a session, and say that I, you know, I had to go and get a dental appointment, and it was all that kind of, it just got too much. They were on to me, the heat was on. And
what made you make up your mind?
They got rid of me in the end. I was I think they just kind of knew, I think they knew things were kind of starting to take off, and I was getting less and less interested.
Yes.
And you know, you can't be an architect and not be
fascinated
really on it.
And on it, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But there's a big correlation between sort of music and architecture.
Yeah, the process can be quite similar in terms of, like, you know, taking very loose kind of sketch ideas and starting to develop them up. But I suppose with architecture, it's a long process from, like, you start designing something until it's finished. It's like 4 years.
Yes.
Where a song, you can kind of almost do it in a night. And that's what I enjoyed, you know, that kind of instantaneous, like, kind of thing about it.
If there's ever any building work or anything to build on stage, Vinny's straight there with his with his screwdriver, like, right, measuring tape, looking at the angles. He loves it. So.
Perfect. That's what you need in the band, you know what I mean?
Definitely, yeah.
I like to visit architecture when I go touring, if I can. I've got any time, because I've got a bit of a fetish for it, you know.
Oh, really? What have you gone on?
Well, I was into the Brutalist, and I was part of a group online for a while, and I was able to kind of go around where I go to these ex-Soviet places.
Oh, really? Wow.
Take pictures and put them up online, and everybody would be like, "Ooh, she got this and she got this." It was great, but it was very Trainspotter-ish.
Yeah.
But love a bit of architecture.
Yeah.
Top
Brutalist
stuff
was amazing.
So, what kind of painter are you?
I was really into collage stuff, so like Kurt Schwitters and a lot of like American pop art, Jasper Johns and Rosenberg and people like that.
So, are you involved in the artwork that you put on sleeves and things?
Yeah, I did the first album artwork even before the album was made. Because my dream was always to design record sleeves, you know.
Yes.
Grew up looking at great 60s records in the house that my dad had and just imagining being Peter Blake or someone, you know. So I got excited and made the album cover before we'd even got a record deal.
And they've never let you do it since?
No, I just don't have the time now. I do some of the videos.
Do you direct the videos?
Yeah, the default one I did. And then most of them I'll have some kind of hand in.
Yeah.
Whether I come up with the idea and then work with someone. Or
you did the Marble Skies one?
Yeah, I did the latest one, Marble Skies. And yeah, it's just if an idea comes, I'll put it forward rather than try to get a hand in.
It's the modern way, really, I think. I direct my videos too.
Yeah.
Right. I have done for a few years. It's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Don't know if you find it difficult. I find it exceptionally draining.
To get what's
doesn't matter
in your
how
head
much
screen,
money you
yeah.
have, you want to make it look like three times as much.
Yeah.
Money.
Yeah.
So it's not even about budgets. In the end, it's about your expectation from the budget.
It's amazing how budgets evaporate.
They
so
just do.
Quickly.
And I try to make them like work triple time. So it's hard.
It's
very, very rewarding.
Yeah.
And in some ways, like a performance on set on the day, you know, it's. Do you feel that? Do you feel that it's maybe like almost like a stage?
Yeah, yeah.
In itself?
Yeah. And then to see it on screen is quite like, wow.
Well, it's either wow or it's like, oh my God.
Yeah, wow or oh no, we need a new video.
Oh, it's just that. And also when you say yes to doing something like that outside of the music,
do you do other
you don't
people's...
realise what the yes means, and then you have to actually do it.
Do you do other people's music
no,
videos?
No, I haven't done
right.
yet, but I would like to.
Yeah.
But I'd probably get bigger budgets for other people's videos, which would
actually
probably
yourself.
Still make me have a have a breakdown. But anyway, you met in an art school. Do you consider yourself an art school group or an art school musicians?
I don't think so. I mean, I never, it's funny because when we travel around, people band the term art around as like music, like saying, you know, just using this umbrella term that is so varied.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you're
art rock.
You're a music band.
Art
be like
pop,
saying,
yeah,
art rock. And or like two words cringe me out, art and rock. And when you put them together, it's like art rock. It's like, what is art? What is rock? I don't even know.
No.
So I don't know what art rock is, you know, and I guess it's hard. People,
there's a story, you know, it's a classic, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
You've got your Roxy Music blueprint there. They all met in art school.
School the
band.
Yeah.
And it's not as if it doesn't fit you terribly badly.
As
an idea.
Yeah.
In terms of how open the production is that you're taking in. You're very free in what you're taking in as an influences here and there. And obviously there's a lot of thought that goes into it.
I think one thing art school teaches you is how to be self-sufficient. You know, if you go to art school and want to make a sculpture, you can't wait till you have the money there. You've got to rake around in a skip or find the stuff yourself. No one's going to give you, you know, here's 10 grand to make a giant golden mushroom. You've got to try and let...
It'd be nice, though, wouldn't it?
It would be nice to have 10 grand to make a giant golden mushroom, but... Yeah, you've got to just be DIY, and that taught us. So we were making our own tracks and putting them on MySpace or whatever, putting our own records out rather than waiting, you know, for a record deal. And it is a cliche that bands meet at art school, but they do. And as you say, it's because a lot of people that are on the same wavelength end up there, you know.
Yes.
Music and art go so kind of hand in hand.
But you did finish your course, did you, as well? You both finished your courses.
I did a postgrad at Chelsea.
Oh, yes.
But by then we were gigging and stuff, so.
By then what were you into when you were in Chelsea? You were deep in the collage game at that stage.
No, there was a guy there I met called Haroon Mirza, who's quite a sort of big artist now, but he was into taking synths apart and making this weird sort of sound art, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
So I got quite into that and did some stuff with him and tried to push things rather than just making more little collages. But really just the idea of the band was so much more appealing by then and exciting that really took all my energy.
It's obviously given you the outlets. For me too, you know, I wanted to do art. I wanted to be a visual artist. Even from a little child, that's exactly what I thought I was going to do. And I ended up in music almost accidentally.
Yeah.
But it gave me opportunity all the time to be as visual as I wanted to be, you know.
Yeah.
More so, maybe. It's really nice to think about how elemental music is and that it brings all these disparate people and ideas and modes of creativity. It can be like a magnet to all of that.
Yeah.
And I often think how also it just affects everyone in a way that art doesn't affect everyone.
Yeah. Mm.
It's there in the air, like another part of the elemental sort of structure of life almost.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And the idea of having your song on the radio, as you say, like in the air, floating through the air, entering people's homes from all backgrounds and all classes and all, you know, is that to if you're a painter, you have to rely on the fact that people need to get out to the gallery and see you.
You can see the paint on the canvas. It's a tangible thing. It's a thing that's made magic out of something that's a sort of piece of matter. But music isn't even that. Music is not, you can't see it.
Yeah.
It's the bit, it's made out of maths, like, you know. Mm. So it's
very weird.
Sort of, I'm very proud that the beginning of everything else that I love to do is music. Although sometimes I do take it for granted, the music part of it. I just go, oh yeah, that's too easy, you know. So let's go back to you. Three albums. You're on your third album. You came out last year, did it?
It came out in the start of February, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you always in control of all the production, or have you farmed any of that out or collaborated with anyone outside of the band?
At the second album, we worked with more of an engineer type guy. And we went to this studio called Angelic, which is in the countryside in Oxfordshire somewhere.
Yes.
And previously everything had been made in the bedroom, literally just sat on the end of the bed kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we thought, oh, we'll go into a rock and roll studio, you know, like you see on the telly. And this place was like, you know, Robbie Williams had just been there and Atomic Kitten and that. And
Atomic Kitten.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we kind of got a bit lost there. Just didn't quite know what the hell we were doing.
Yeah.
These kind of bumbling bedroom
guys. Got lost musically there, you feel?
Musically and
geographically. We were living in like farm enormous buildings, just like outbuildings.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just, I suppose just being in a city and just cutting through, you know, like even if you need like a break.
Yes.
You go and take a walk, you know. And,
yes, that's
and just
right,
see
yeah
stuff where if you're just in the middle of like fields and you've got like a horse to kind of talk to.
You would
about
go and talk
yeah
to the horse.
I was just going
problems.
Yeah, exactly.
We did a lot of Ouija boards.
Ouija boards.
Trying to contact.
Did you?
Dave.
Yeah.
I read you were into that actually.
Yeah. I sort of drag the others along and try.
Well, Dave's into it. We all just got no, carried along.
Humour me.
Was it scary? Did it ever get scary?
There was a brilliant, the guy played a brilliant trick on us where he had this, so we were doing the Ouija boards in this old room that was part of the old building, and so they properly laid out like a pentangle on the floor and everything one night, and we were like, right, let's do this, and I put on a cape and kind of like was like the master
the Lord,
of ceremonies.
Laird of the Ouija board.
And, there was this really, really old Victorian piano in the corner, like an ancient one, sort of music hall one, and we were doing this Ouija board and we contacted this guy. What was he called?
Jeff.
So it's spelled out Jeff on the thing. We're like, oh my God, here's Jeff. And just as we started speaking to him, the piano just went
in the corner.
And we were absolutely just...
It went on its own.
Yes.
The piano.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it went...
Ding. It went ding, 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 ding.
That was definitely someone who's in the band, one of you lots.
Well, we ran
that
out. Tommy, there was a field next to the studio. Tommy ran all the way through the fields to like the end of the field, didn't he? Past the horse.
Yeah.
The way.
Oh, God.
And, yeah, bastards. Turned out they'd wired up this old piano.
Oh.
So it was all like, it'd all been
to
kind
play
of
itself.
You could kind of program it and record it, yeah, but it was all kind of behind the scenes.
But I really,
I had an automatron type thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I really shat it. I thought we'd contacted a very angry piano
player. I think your very words were, you witnessed it now. You've witnessed it. Like,
this changes everything, I said. That was my life.
The famous life.
This changes
everything.
But
did you
everything
do any music? Did you do any
no
music?
We did Ouija boards and played table tennis, and that's why our
table
album
tennis
failed. Well, that, yeah, getting back to the point was that
you did finish an album though. Yes. Did you do the bulk of it there? You did.
Yeah.
But yeah, just being in this massive studio, like far apart from each other physically.
So you don't. I was listening to some of that today. It sounded pretty good to me. I mean, it's
the
not
second one. Yeah, I don't know.
I think we just did it. It was just, I think we were just about, you know, things like the edit, you know, the track listing, and it was just about too long. I think we were.
What about the label at that stage of the game? Were you dealing well with them or?
Yeah, our label's great. Yeah. Just let us get on with things. And
did you feel the pressure from the success of the first record? Obviously, that's a really cliched question.
I'm not sure that. Maybe pressure of like, how much money is this place costing a day?
You felt that way. You felt that.
Just that, can we waste time here? Because, you know, like making music, there's so much.
But that's a healthy
procrastination
thing to feel.
Yeah, you have to procrastinate to get anything out, really.
Well,
in a way. Well, you have to think, you have to sit around and think about what it is you're doing and trial and error and all that. And so when you're in this big studio, I mean, we hadn't written any demos. We didn't know what we were doing, basically.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so we've gone back to more of the first album approach of just self-contained.
You said you've built a little
place. A little studio in Tottenham. Yeah, just a self-contained unit there, really, now.
Mm. Yeah, it was good. It was good to get into that process. It just meant you could kind of like do the procrastination and faff around, but you didn't feel pressured about it, you know. You could just like go in. If you didn't you know, if you went in for a day or two and nothing really happened, it didn't really matter.
Here I am, Roisin Murphy, and you're listening to The Sync Sessions, brought to you by Heineken. Live your music. So, to me, your music, some way like my own, has a tension between a kind of interest and a curiosity about formulas and what they do and why they're strong, and then that far out kind of side to yourself that wants to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that's a difficult tension to kind of balance? Do you think it's there? Am I right? Like,
yeah, I think that's similar to us. You know, we pop stuff that also gets people dancing when I DJ would be, you know, it might be Prince or Missy Elliott, or it might be mm-hmm. the Beatles or the Clash, but there's something tying that all together, which is someone wanting to make accessible music but keep it quite weird or keep mm-hmm. it interesting, you know. And that was sort of our plan at the start, if we had one, was, you know, how can we make accessible music but keep it, you know, odd, keep the textures good, you know, keep
yourself interested,
yeah,
and challenged.
And making a great dance record, I think's very weird, and maybe people don't really think of us as dance music, and I don't think we are really, but being a DJ, seeing what makes people dance, you know, it's definitely not 4/4 as, you know, I'll go to these places to DJ in Croatia or Spain and it's guys just seamlessly mixing a house beat and people are trying to dance, but there's a soul
that's missing. Yeah.
And then you put on the Rolling Stones and everyone goes crazy, you know. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one to try and get right. I think live in the studio, we treat them as almost two different things. Mm-hmm. So live, we'll really study, like, how did we'll see a band like The Hives on before us. Like, how did The Hives get everyone so worked up?
Yes.
With just that big drum roll. And you see these clips of these huge, I don't really know their names, but these superstar DJs now that
it's
are
the
just
same
playing
now
to
for
60,
bands
000.
Now, in fairness.
Yeah.
It's a body of, especially these days, and people are so demanding.
Yeah.
And they are used to switching on their telephone, on their computer to the next thing, the next thing. The
next thing.
That, you know, this, as we were talking about festivals earlier, the bigger the festival as well, the bigger the festival audience, the more you've got to, like, do a festival set.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that we're aware of and talk about quite a lot and try and tailor and tweak. And
if you're on at 1 o'clock in the morning at festival versus 6 o'clock, you know, in Switzerland, you know, you've got to kind of try to work out the sunset and, like, you know, what kind of crowd is it?
Yeah, and are we going on too long in this one? Are people getting bored? And maybe people didn't used to think that way before.
Audiences have definitely become more demanding in many ways. But it's great when you get it right and you get the balance right between understanding that there should be some awareness of these things, but then you're in danger, obviously, of becoming bland.
Yeah, of trying to please everyone.
Yeah.
Well, that's what
killing yourselves like that, you know, which can kill a band or an act or an artist also.
I guess that's the flip side to becoming a stadium band, is that you've ironed out everything in order to fit everywhere, you know. And I don't think we're ever in danger of, like, making stadium rock or, you know, bits of our sets, just a kick drum and a cowbell, the way that ESG would have done, that really gets people going.
Yeah.
When you work that out, that's the simplistic stuff that's best.
Sometimes the plentiest,
That can be fun.
Let's talk about singing. So the harmonies on this record, is you the only singer or is there other people singing?
No, me and the bass player, Jim, sing.
They're lovely. You do beautiful harmonies.
Thank you.
So, when did you discover you could sing?
I was forced into St. Eugene's Cathedral Choir in Derry when I was about 10, against my will, by my granny. And then,
would that have been hard to get into?
It was, yeah. It was reasonably difficult, but she knew the bishop. So,
oh, I bet she did.
And for her, it was a good look, you know.
For sure.
Because that was her local chapel. So I was kind of put into that. And then I kind of learnt. We had, like, this really good conductor who... Donald Doherty went on to do, like, kind of the national
amazing
choirs and stuff. But, like, so I kind of understood quite crazy.
Did you have
harmonies,
a little high voice?
Yeah. But we did. It was really, like, loads of weird discord. You know when in those kind of cathedral choirs, they can kind of sum up hell at times through really, you know, like, really weird harmonies. They have to, you know, there's the light and the dark, and you could listen to, like, a tenor singing a really weird chord against yours. And
so that's in your music.
So I kind of, I didn't really think about it really, but, like, I just always, I was kind of liked, you know, my dad was always into, like, Crosby, Stills and Nash and Simon and Garfunkel. And then I got into kind of people like Broadcast and Caribou, who we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that kind of quite gentle style of singing, it was always kind of really appealed to me. But then when I started working with Dave, he would go, right, give us the main line, and I would do it. And he was like, right, give me a harmony. And I would just be able to, like, go within a couple of minutes, we'd have layered up, like, five kind of weird harmonies.
It's really very effective and
so
beautiful.
But I hadn't really thought about it until somebody asked me about it later. And I was like, oh, it's probably me being in that choir that kind of like, but I was able to do it kind of relatively quickly or whatever.
Because it's something I don't know if I've even got my head around it yet. And I've been singing, so-called singing for 25 years.
But your soul vocal can carry, you know, itself, where mine's quite like, it's just one texture.
And I find it as an amazing ability. Do you think you might be pitch perfect?
Not last night, apparently I wasn't.
All right.
The front of the house was like, you're a bit off. Yeah, no, I think like me and Jim like work quite well together. Our vocals quite, you know, fit well.
Coincidentally.
And it was just a coincidence.
So as you may or may not know, each podcast, the artist that I'm speaking to will choose 10 great tracks or 10 tracks or 10 of the favourite tracks of all time for the moment, whatever. And you will be able to listen to those tracks on my playlist on Roisin Murphy Spotify afterwards. And they're really great tracks that have been chosen today by Django. Really great. Some really like perfect records like this one, Public Enemy, Can't Do Nothing For You Man. It was one of my favourite tracks when I was little.
Yeah.
I had that album when I was a kid in Manchester.
Yeah.
And this is almost pop, no?
Yeah, it's a kind of comedy song. And it's got Flavor Flav cackling. I bought Fear of a Black Planet when it came out, and my mum was a bit kind of dubious to rap music, you know.
Oh, the rap music.
And
yeah.
There was a skateboard video called Attack that was getting passed around, and I asked my friend what the music was on it, and he said Public Enemy. You know, turns out it was actually Bomb the Bass. But so I got my mum to take me to Our Price and get this cassette tape, and I just listened to it over and over and over again in my headphones, and kind of got me into production because I just couldn't. I was used to listening to the Beatles and Pink Floyd and stuff,
yes.
And because I was pretty young. And the production, I couldn't get my head around it. I just
what it was like.
Well, it wasn't
space.
How they did it, and I didn't know what sampling was. So I thought that there was a guy going in a studio somewhere doing just that Public Enemy lick, you know. And it just fascinated me, and that song stood out because I was still young, and it just was such a comedy kind of song. And yeah. I was starting to get my head around the topics that Public Enemy were talking about. And
it's such a good dance track.
Really
one.
Good dance track.
Yeah.
Yeah. All that album's full of, you know, Fight the Power. Like amazing dance beats. Yeah.
Yes, incredible. Ever see them live?
I actually have never seen them live. No, unfortunately. But I still might because, I mean, we've had our dressing room next to them a few times, and
oh wow,
I've
really?
Been, yeah,
really?
And I've been scared to, I've seen Chuck D and been sort of too scared to ask for his autograph or whatever. There was one time when we were parked in a coach and it was Chuckle Brothers to one side and Public Enemy
to the
other. Oh, he
died the other day, God rest his soul.
Barry.
Yes, Barry.
Ah.
And Barry, Public Enemy and the Chuckle Brothers got their photo taken together.
A beautiful collector's item, I'd say.
Yeah, how did they know each other?
Why didn't you sandwich yourself in between
I should have done it. We'd have been iconic.
I mean, you could have given up everything. All,
exactly.
All of everything. Chuckle Brothers, Public Enemy. Sandwich.
Yeah, my childhood was right there. Yeah.
Mean anything to you, the rap music, the hip hop?
I got Monsters of Rap, a cassette when I was skiing when I was about 12. It had a Public Enemy track on it and Sometime Dog. And that was kind of, there wasn't, I don't know, hip hop and Derry wasn't kind of a thing as much. It was, well, there was a couple of people kind of listening to it, but it was more hardcore rave and stuff like dance music, and Derry would have been more prolific in a way.
Yes.
I think this was pre-rave, so people were still,
it was, yeah,
it was 88 or something, so people were still, people at my school were listening to like Duran Duran or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then here
the dog
was
is outside the door, by the way.
Good following. So that's why Public Enemy just seemed like such a slam in the face, you know, this mad music.
Is that what you were looking for? Something to slam them in the face with? You're trying to find
a little
something
bit,
to
a little
shock
bit.
People or shock, well, your parents or
yeah, a little
fight
bit.
The power?
Getting to that age where you want your Clash or Sex Pistols, you want your kind of thing that kicks you in sort of thinking about the rest of the world and the modern world and whatnot, rather than your dad's record collection. So that was the album for me, really.
Do you think music still does that for people?
Yeah, definitely. And going back to saying, you know, it's harder as you get older to see why sometimes with bands. But yeah, I mean, it's tons of exciting stuff. kids are still discovering, you know.
And they get that feeling of, like, I sort of help with their identity.
Definitely, yeah. Mm. And stuff that I don't... A lot of modern hip-hop, I don't quite get it, a lot of the trap stuff. Or,
do you like any modern hip-hop?
I do, yeah. I got the last Kanye produced the Nas record. I got that. Yeah, I get bits and bobs.
Yeah.
And there's gems everywhere, you know.
Just of course. Gotta dig around. Yeah. Still listen to hip hop?
Well, I was kind of more in the breakbeat stuff.
Vinny. I'm gonna ask that again because I got confused. I think I keep thinking I'm talking to Erasure.
That's all right.
Do you still listen to hip hop, Vinny?
Well, I was kind of more on the, like, breakbeat kind of stuff, and I subsequently, you know, in the kind of mid to late 90s got into that, or yeah. Sort of middle of the 90s, and then I kind of went back and looked at all the origins of, like, you know, the way you always find out about something, and you go back and discover where they kind of got all the kind of drum hooks and stuff. So I was quite big into that, but maybe not so much straight, like, hip-hop as much.
So, like, sort of DJ Shadow,
DJ Food, all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and then I kind of looked out for that kind of stuff, and subsequent, you know, if I found a band that had a kind of that crossover, because obviously I didn't have the kind of production side of things, but, you know, like a lot of kraut rock kind of stuff, which kind of played, and that was kind of quite minimal drums, you know, and bass. That was kind of, I went to, because I could imagine myself playing that, you know, or something like Devo or the Monks or something like that, you know, kind of quite tight, almost like motoric kind of groove to it.
Yeah.
I could always say, oh, that's how potentially if I ever did it,
you can identify with it.
But yeah.
Let's talk about Spiral Tribe, Ragaboom.
Yeah, that was mine.
Some kind of a surprising one to find.
Yeah, well, I guess it's the first record I remember buying that was really a modern rave record for me.
Right.
You know, it was like I was wary of a lot of rave music until I got into stuff like our first Prodigy album.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of got it. And then I think maybe this was before then, but I bought this record and just kind of blew me away. And it had this sort of elements of hip hop and Public Enemy and stuff. Just sped up, and I think at the first time I put it on, I thought it was the wrong speed because I didn't understand breakbeat or
There's a great revival of this kind of sound, and people finding old tapes, and just a kind of people looking to save this sort of music from oblivion, which I think is really good. It's a very British,
definitely.
You know, most forms of music that fall in between sort of success and non-existence, you know, with anything going for it, there's usually a British scene, a revivalist British scene, or a curational sort of set of DJs somewhere, making sure that these things don't get lost forever, reissuing them. And
aye, totally.
And it's very much of the moment, this particular sort of rave era, because the music seemed at the time to be so plentiful and disposable. No, it's like a crisp packet music or something, you know, you drink it away.
Yeah. Mm.
But there's an energy, like a mood again. It's a mood thing with music, with anything, with a film to me, or a painting, or everything else is secondary to having a mood of some that means something to people, that really evokes some feeling.
Definitely.
And it's steeped in that moment, isn't it? This type of music.
Yeah.
That sort of turn into people starting to really open up in some way, no?
Yeah, definitely. And it felt almost like, to me, it was starting to get into rave and understand the rave scene, and how it operated felt almost like our version of Woodstock or something. It had this freedom and this spirit about it, and Spiral Tribe kind of really summed that up, because they put on free parties and did the sound system scene and all that. So it was quite hippie in a way. Which
it was hippie, but also a little bit, what's it called? The punk philosophy begins with R.
Anarchist.
Yeah.
No, definitely they had.
It was quite anarchic.
They had an anarchist streak, definitely. And they looked mental. They all had shaved heads. Even the girls had skinheads and bought black bomber jackets. And they looked crazy.
And there was an idea that they might change the world.
Totally. I mean, the EP is called Forward the Revolution on that track. So there was this idea of, like, free parties and free raves changing the world the way that
so people
thought that.
So why is that thing? Do you think that thing's become laughable now? It seems almost naive.
I think it's almost just, it's much harder to not sell out. You know, at that time, people were selling. You could go platinum with a drum and bass record, with a jungle record, because mm-hmm. people were lapping up.
And buying it on an actual form.
Yeah. Mm. And so people were selling a lot of techno and rave records. Now it's like, well, how do you do that? Or how do you make money?
For DJs, it's DJing, isn't it?
For DJs, it's DJing. Even now, a lot of DJs I know who are almost big names struggle, you know. But it's difficult. It's much harder not to sell that or not to be involved in things. So I don't know. It goes back to that generational thing of, I don't really know what it's like coming up now through the system. You know, for us, it was the beginning of MySpace and music being shared online and the beginning of music being free and passed around.
And that was part of what got you going. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So without it,
look down
we wouldn't
it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a different time.
For me too. I mean, I think because my greatest communication is through my social media, through to my fans, that's always there for me. And it's a good anchor in a way, because I always feel like I've got somebody to make music for and to make imagery for, and there's a point to it. Whereas in the old days, you were just throwing it out there into a kind of black sea and saying bye bye, unless you were on Top of the Pops.
Right. Mm. Did you go on Top of the Pops?
Oh, I was on Top of the Pops a few times. Weren't you? No, it was part of your time.
It finished by the time we came along.
Oh, we can set up Top of the Pops round at my hotel. Come down.
Let's do it. Get Keith Chegwin down.
Oh, Keith. So, a fantastic band, Caribou. And this track is incredible. It's like the most perfect track.
It's like a kind of West Coast 70s.
And then it just surprises you.
Yeah. That's what I kind of liked. Well, I suppose I got into Dance Nath when he was Manitoba, and then it became Caribou. And that album, Milk of Human Kindness, was quite mesmerizing when you listen to it. It just goes everywhere, you know. And that's what I really enjoy about, I suppose, all our shared musical taste and mine, that just being able to cut in between different things and not being too honed in on a certain area, you know, that's your kind of space that you always, you know, certain type of music that you like. You know, 1 minute it would be like a break, and then it would be that kind of, that track B's. But it's kind of perfect. And his singing style as well was kind of exactly what I really wanted. You know, like when I heard that, I was like, his voice is almost like an instrument just amongst the music. Mm. But yeah, it's got that kind of mad kind of break at the end. But it's a really nice track. And then it's just been nice seeing how he's developed, you know, through...
How long have they been going now? Long time.
So it was late 90s, he was Manitoba. And then he did that album, and then did Andorra and Swim, and now he's Daphne. You know, it's just been a really weird and quite sort of intriguing path he's taken.
Yeah.
We played live with him, and was it Melt in Germany? Mm-hmm. And we played it's before him, and it was just like, I was totally, you know, I couldn't talk to him. The show was amazing. Actually, it reminded me of what we try to do in some ways, like in terms of, it's dance music, but it's all done through live percussion, you know, and it's all very tactile. You know, minimize all the kind of samples and stuff like that, which I think that's the way we kind of began and try to kind of keep it, you know. So there's always a risk to the live performance with him. It's not all pre-programmed and you know, but yeah, he's totally amazing.
Yeah, so I saw Caribou years ago at the festival, and I was blown away. Simple stage setup, just sublime, really.
Yeah.
So this has this incredible
guitar hook.
Weird sound that comes in, which surprised me, I have to say. God, I loved it. That's one of those things that's just like, yes, stick it to them.
Yeah.
Brilliant track.
Yep.
Well, that was just such a lovely discussion. Thank you so much for coming in. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And I wish you all the best with your creative experiments going forward.
Same with
you. Thank you. Same.
Cheers.
To get your hands on tickets to the hottest gigs and festivals, visit heinekenmusic.ie. Heineken, live your music. Enjoy Heineken responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie.